And I wanted to write something that would try and capture this whole thing about skateboarding is street, but it's also park. It's about individuals, but it's also about collective. It's about white male teenagers, but it's also about gay black females. It's all, you know, older females, that it's countercultural, but it's also business, that it takes place in LA, but you can also go to, you know, Mongolia and find skateboarding, that it's a sport, but it's a subculture, and that there's photography and there's art and there's music and there's all kinds of social enterprises and charities that use skateboarding as a way to reach hard to reach youth. I wanted to, everything that there was about this kind of wonderful world of skateboarding, I wanted to try and capture.
Hello, and welcome to Design Meets Insight, Heta Architects podcast, where we share some of the fascinating and inspiring conversations we're having with thinkers and creators in and around the world of architecture and design. I'm your host, Namrata Krishna. I'm a design strategy lead at Heta, and for this episode, my co-host is the fabulous and lovely Nikki Whiteman, who is the head of emerging trends at global real estate business Savills. Our guest for this episode, Ian Borden, is professor of architecture and urban culture at the Bartlett School of Architecture in London. His research explores how architecture and cities are experienced and reused by the public. In particular, he's completed an in-depth study of the urban practice of skateboarding, and his most recent book is called Skateboarding and the City, A Complete History. Nikki and I really loved our conversation with Ian. It was so fascinating and really fun, actually. Nikki, why did you want Ian to come on the podcast?
I guess, firstly, you know, there are a lot of people in my family who love skateboarding. So they're all super excited that we're doing this. So there's always lots of chat about skateboarding at home. As part of my work, and I know this is the same for you, we spend a lot of our time, I think, talking about projects and the focus on attempting to create these inclusive places. And I think the work that Ian has done over a long period of time now has always been really fascinating to me, looking at this relationship between skating, skate culture, and cities and urban places and public realm. So, as you say, it was a really fun conversation. We started off by asking Ian about how skate culture has changed and evolved over the years.
The 70s, you were a surfer dude, maybe dudess, but probably a dude. And you were probably white, and you were probably a teenage male. And now a lot of skateboarders are still white teenage males. But they're also every other ethnicity you can think of. They're also increasingly female, and they're, you know, of different ages. So I've skated on and off for, you know, 40 odd years. So when I go to skate now, I will skate. My group of skaters is everyone from kind of 8 years old to, I'm the oldest, very late 50s, all different, you know, backgrounds of every way you can possibly imagine and different body shapes. So they're much more, it's a much more inclusive terrain and diversity of people with all that goes with it. It's still, you know, there are still more males than females, I would say. I don't think that's to be disputed, but Sky Brown, even before she won her gold medal at the Olympics, there was, you know, she's a big Instagram star. And skateboarding lives on Instagram. And lots of people had seen her on Instagram or on, you know, other social media. And even before the Olympics, we've seen a massive increase in young female skaters wanting to skate because they've seen Sky Brown. You know, she can do it, why can't I? You know, it's not just for my brother, it's not just for the boys, it's for me. So that's been a massive change.
One of the things that interests me about skateboarding is that the ability to do something where you don't need to have or spend a lot of money on the kit. Presumably, it's pretty accessible. You know, boards, you can spend quite a lot of money on a board, but I guess you don't need to.
Yeah, I mean, an expensive skateboard. If you bought the top of the range, as it were, skateboard, you might get to £200, you know, but most people don't spend anything like that. You can get a very good, you know, perfectly serviceable skateboard that you know, for well under 100, under 50 pounds, you know. So the barrier to access in equipment is you need a board and you really need a helmet, you know, and that's it. But most people start off with a board that, you know, used to belong to their older sister or their uncle or a mate, or they just turn up at the skate park, and quite often, some various reasons, people bring multiple boards. So the barrier to access like that is not great. And that applies to everyone, not just kids, to, you know, adults who are getting into skateboarding as well. You know, you don't need fancy equipment, but there's also other, you know, barriers to access, which accessibility, which don't really exist in skateboarding, which is, you know, you don't need 21 other people and a referee and an official pitch and agree to all meet at exactly 11 o'clock and play for 90 minutes. Oh, and by the way, we ought to go training every Tuesday night in advance. Oh, and by the way, I've got to commit to do this every week. You know, you can just rock up. And, you know, whenever you like, you know, raining permitting, or what if it's an indoor skate park when it's open, and you can stay as long as you like. You know, some of the kids at the skate park will stay there all day from, you know, 9 till God knows when. I go for 2 or 3 hours and then I'm done. And you can go, you know, 10 times a week or once every in a blue moon. You just go whenever you want. And then when you get there, you can kind of do whatever you like. You know, there's no competition, there's no winners, there's no league, there's no point system. You know,
I think that's definitely something we saw at the Olympics. I think it was really noticeable that when the skaters finished their runs, just how supportive they all were of each other, yeah, in a way that seemed really genuine and, yeah, really noticeable, I think, in sport. Yeah.
And it is genuinely genuine. You know, take nothing away. But they are competing. They all wanted to win. But what's winning? You know, winning is winning the gold medal. It's winning the silver medal. It's winning the bronze medal. But any skateboarder that did that in a kind of anything that smacked of absolute ruthlessness would be completely castigated. And shunned by, cancelled by the skateboard world community, such as it is. The whole point, you know, there's sort of this truism that the best surfer is the one having the most fun on the wave. The best skateboarder is the one having the most fun in the skate park.
That's great.
And that's an authentic part of skateboarding. You will often find that the person that gets the biggest cheer at the skate park is the person who, you know, for the first time has learned to drop in on a bowl or has just done a move that they've been trying for weeks. And it doesn't mean that no one else can do it. It's because they've achieved a personal achievement. So skateboarding is all about pushing your own boundaries. And setting your own kind of targets, or just finding your own pleasures and staying within them. And I think that's really good in skateboarding, but it's also really good as a kind of model of how we might like to behave towards each other. You know, the book I wrote on skateboarding the city, the conclusion, such as there is to it, is this sort of thing that actually you know, you want people to try things. You want people to take risks. You want people to fail and learn through their failure. You want them to be independent and at the same time have a sense of camaraderie and community and support for each other. And skateboarding does that. You know, it's a wonderful culture in that respect.
And so how do you design for that inclusive culture? How does that impact how you design a skate park, for example?
I mean, the important thing about skate parks is they're not sports facilities. You know, they are essentially public spaces at which a bit of skateboarding takes place. And if you go to a skate park, there's an awful lot of standing around talking and watching. You know, I probably spend 90% of my time talking to other people. And it's, you know, because you can't, you know, it's quite you use quite a lot of energy on a skate run. So you might do a run for 30 seconds and then wait 3 or 4 minutes for your next run. And there's a sort of informal queuing system, etiquette around skate parks as well as to who goes next. It's a bit like the cheese counter at Sainsbury's. You know, everyone's taken a ticket and waits their turn. But I know I go after the person with the yellow T-shirt, and she knows that she goes after the guy in the death metal sweatshirt, and he knows that the kid on the purple scooter, and you know, so there's a sort of, you kind of watch out for people going on. But the space around the skate park is also important, you know, where people stand, where they sit, where they watch, the people who are not riding and are just watching, and you know, the mums and dads or the boyfriends, girlfriends of the people there hang around as well. So the space of the skate park isn't just the riding surface, it's the terrain around it. And good skate parks take that into consideration as well. They get landscape designers on board and, you know, design that space as a nice place to be as well.
So, Ian, in addition to the more formal design skate parks, what's the relationship between skating and skate culture and the city more generally?
The skateboarders often talk about skate parks, and then they talk about street, real street, mm-hmm. the sort of street that is just there for other reasons and they like to go and skate. And the thing that's kind of in between that is a sort of skateable space. So I would call the Undercroft in London or the plaza in front of MACBA in Barcelona or the Cultural Forum, I would call those skateable spaces. They weren't designed for skateboarding, but they're heavily used by skaters. And you could say, well, what does that give for skateboarding? But you can reverse it round the other way and ask the question, what does skateboarding bring to the city? What benefits does it bring? And it's quite interesting that so to give the example of the Undercroft in London. So we think that skateboarders have been skating at the Undercroft since 1972, probably, something like that. So for a good 40 odd years. And that was a space that was, you know, I won't go into the architectural theory of it, but the architects deliberately left it kind of open and ambiguous what was going to take place there. And they thought that maybe there might be artist pop-up markets and things like that. But anyhow, skateboarding arrived. And then there was this proposition by the South Bank Centre to move the skateboarding along a bit to underneath the Hungerford Bridge. And they weren't trying to get rid of skateboarding. They liked the skateboarding being there, but for commercial reasons and because of the way the South Bank Centre funding was working, they needed to try and extend their revenue stream. So they had a proposition to move skateboarding along. And I think there might have been some advantages to that, but there were a lot of disadvantages to it. And there was a big campaign done by the Long Live South Bank group to keep skateboarding in that space. And 150,000 people signed that petition, which is an extraordinary number of people. Now, why were they doing that? Well, on one level, they were supporting skateboarding. People like to see skateboarding. It's great. But I think what they were really doing, apart from just supporting skateboarding, was saying we don't want all our public spaces and cities to be another mocha frappuccino sushi opportunity, which is what would have happened there. Not that there's anything wrong with a mocha frappuccino and some sushi, but you don't want the whole of the city to be like that. And I think what people were saying is that we want an element of difference and surprise and diversity in our public spaces. We want to see people who are not just sitting down eating or drinking. We want to see people of all different ages and backgrounds. We want to see and hear different colours and noises going on. And the Undercroft delivers that in spades. It's a different kind of, you know, item on the menu of urban space. And skateboarding, I think, therefore, is a way that I think, you know, we're all trying to have our public spaces much more inclusive and welcoming. And skateboarding is a way of doing that, of introducing that into the public realm.
And what about disused or meanwhile spaces? I mean, that seems ideal for skateboarding or, you know, potentially other kinds of urban sports.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. That's a really good part of it. And that, you know, there's been quite a few examples of people that have done pop-up or meanwhile uses. So just very recently in London, we've had the van sponsored thing on the Strand, where they're just some temporary obstacles. You don't have to build skateboarding facilities as great big concrete landscapes. They can just be a few obstacles. They can be temporary. They can be made of wood. They can be made of fiberglass. They actually can even, there's even a way of building a concrete skate park that's temporary. You use foam to make the main shape, and then you spray a thin layer of concrete over it, and it can be removed quite quickly. So there's lots of different ways of doing that, and including the interiors of buildings. So I'm fervently waiting for the first person to think, you know, what do we do with that old shopping mall that's not being used so much at the moment? And you're seeing people including things like mini golf into shopping malls and other kinds of activities like that. And, you know, someone somewhere is going to realize that skateboarding might be an opportunity there as well.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the kind of thing that people might be interested in. One of the questions I have, and you slightly touched on it there, is we're obviously thinking about every project we do, what impact we're having. Are people thinking about design of skate parks in a way that is really thinking about environmental impact?
Yeah, so there's a certain amount of work that's going on with concrete at the moment. You know, obviously a big concrete skate park is made out of concrete. And this is an area a bit side out of my expertise, but I know there are five or six very good, experienced concrete skate park designers, manufacturers, builders in London, and I know this is something that's on their radar. I mean, I think the other thing is one of the reasons why we want to see more skateboarding in public realms is just as a means of transport, and particularly, you know, for the first and last mile, you know, to the tube station and off the other end of the tube station, or that kind of thing. I wouldn't want to ride a street skateboard for more than a mile. People do, but it's quite hard work. But they're very good for that, and they're very easy to pick up and move around. And obviously, there are now electric skateboards as well, battery powered electric skateboards that people do go further distances on. So I'd like to see skateboarding more thought of in as just part of, again, as just one of the many possibilities of moving around the city.
I'm curious about why you wanted to write your book Skateboarding and the City, or maybe why you wanted to write it now.
The reason that I did the book Skateboarding and the City a couple of years ago was partly because skateboarding has changed an awful lot over the 50, 60 years, 70 years that it's been around. And I wanted there to be a history of that, and that no one else had really done that in a, you know, single and sort of substantial volume. So I wanted to capture something of the landscape of skateboarding as it had developed over the years. So I'm trained as a historian. My idea is in 200 years' time, people will be thinking, what was that strange thing they did back in the 20th and 21st century? What was it called? Roller skate planking or something. And someone will say, oh, you need to go and read that old book thing by what's his name, you know, Borden. You know, that'll tell you all about it. So there's that sort of historian's conceit that you want to be the go-to source of it as well. But the other thing I say was that skateboarding had changed massively, and I wanted to write something that would try and capture this whole thing about skateboarding is street, but it's also park. It's about individuals, but it's also about collective. It's about white male teenagers, but it's also about gay black females. It's all, you know, older females. That it's countercultural, but it's also business. That it takes place in LA, but you can also go to, you know, Mongolia and find skateboarding. That it's a sport, but it's a subculture, and that there's photography and there's art and there's music and there's all kinds of social enterprises and charities that use skateboarding as a way to reach hard to reach youth. Everything that there was about this kind of wonderful world of skateboarding, I wanted to try and capture.
Yeah. Ian, could you tell us a bit more about that, you know, about the social impact of skateboarding and how it's being used to build social capital?
One of the things that that's developed a lot with skateboarding in the last 5 or 6 years, partly because there are skate parks around, is there are lots of charity groups and social enterprises that use skateboarding to reach hard to reach youth. So there's a school called the Far Academy in Kent that is a secondary school framed around skateboarding. There are there's a group called Skate Pal, who are based in London, but build skate parks in Palestine as a way of offering facilities to youth in Palestine. And they also work with refugees who come to London. There are all kinds of groups that do skateboard lessons for kids who are autistic or have physical challenges. So skateboarding isn't just about the people who are kind of having a leisure as well. It's a way of engaging. It's a way of engaging people who reaching out to people who otherwise perhaps are slightly isolated or distant from society. You know, people often say it's not the destination, it's the journey. Mm-hmm. It's not the thing, it's the thing that gets you to the thing. It's the way of reaching out and engaging with people. And in a way, the skateboarding is incidental again. What you're building is social capital. And skateboarding is the way you get there.
It feels to me as though one of the messages out of this is if you have a public realm, which so many of the people that we work with do, this may be a really underthought area, I think. Yeah. So I think this could be really powerful.
Yeah. I mean, I think sort of trying to get across this, I don't think anyone's saying, you need to build a skate park. It's more about, I mean, if somebody wants to build a skate park, that's great. But it's more about if you accommodate skaters and some of skate culture, what you get with that is you get everything that comes with that.
Yeah.
And that can be, I think, extraordinarily valuable for people. If you want an inclusive and diverse clientele for your public realm or visitor group, then this is a way of doing it.
That was episode 4 of Design Meets Insight. A big thank you to our guest, Professor Ian Borden, and to Nikki Whiteman from Savills for bringing us all together. We'll be back next month with another episode, so stay tuned. And in the meantime, check out the exciting projects we're doing at HETA on our website, hetaarchitects.com. Also, feel free to get in touch via LinkedIn or email. Nikki and I would love to hear from you and hear what you thought of the episode.